So today, we're going to begin by talking about a change of variables formula. This formula is also called, in many calculus books, the U-substitution. That might be the name by which you know it. So we'll begin with a lemma. If f is a Riemann integrable function on the closed interval AB, and if phi is a continuous function on a compact interval that contains the range of f, then phi composed with f is Riemann integrable. So this is actually a handy little lemma that we'll make good use of later. Proof: let epsilon be greater than zero. Since phi is a continuous function on a compact interval, it is uniformly continuous. Let delta bigger than zero be selected such that delta is less than epsilon, and if absolute x minus y is less than delta, then absolute phi x minus phi y is less than epsilon. Now, the hypothesis that f is Riemann integrable implies that there exists a delta tilde bigger than zero, such that if script p and script p prime are partitions of AB, and the mesh of p and the mesh of p prime are less than delta tilde, then for the common refinement q of p and p tilde, it holds that the Riemann sum of f at p minus the Riemann sum of f at q, all in absolute value, is less than delta squared, and also the Riemann sum of f at p tilde minus the Riemann sum of f at q, all in absolute value, is less than delta squared. Fix such a p, p tilde, and q. Let j sub l be the intervals of q, and I sub j be the intervals of p. Each j sub l is, of course, contained in some I j sub l, j of l. We write absolute value Riemann sum of phi composed with f at p minus Riemann sum of phi composed with f at q is equal to absolute value sum over j phi composed with f at tj times delta j minus sum over l phi composed with f at sl delta l absolute value. And this is equal to absolute value sum over j, sum over j sub l and I sub j of phi composed with f of tj times delta l minus sum over j sub l contained in I sub j phi composed with f of sl dl. So in that step, we broke up all the delta j's into their subintervals from the partition q called delta sub l. And this is equal now to the absolute value of summation over j, summation j sub l in I sub j of the quantity phi composed with f at tj minus phi composed with f at sl, all times delta l. So that's just factoring. And this is less than or equal to two sums, sum over j sub l and I sub j, where l is in g for the good set, and I'll tell you in a minute what the good set is. Quantity phi composed with f at tj minus phi composed with f at sl times delta l, absolute value, plus absolute value summation over j, summation over j sub l and I sub j, l in the bad set b, quantity phi composed with f at tj minus phi composed with f at sl times delta l, absolute value. Now here, g is, we put l in g if j sub l is contained in ij sub l and 0 less than or equal to sup I sub j l of f minus inf I sub j l of f, and that quantity is less than delta. If the quantity is not less than delta, then we put L into B, the bad set. Notice that the summation over L in the bad set of delta times delta L is less than or equal to the summation over L in the bad set of the quantity sup over IJL of F minus inf over IJL of F times delta L, which equals the sum from J equal 1 to K, summation J sub L and I sub J, quantity sup over I sub J of f minus inf over I sub j of f, because I sub j contains j sub l times delta l. And this is equal to the sum from j equal 1 to k sup over I sub j of f minus inf over I sub j of f times I sub j, and this is less than delta squared by the choice of delta tilde. Therefore, summation delta l over l in the bad set is less than delta. Let m, so I've just divided delta out of the previous inequality, because I had summation delta, little delta times big delta L less than delta squared, so I just divided the delta out of that. Let capital M be an upper bound for absolute value phi, then summation, absolute value summation over j, summation over j sub L and I sub j, L in the bad set of the quantity phi composed with f at tj minus phi composed with f at sl times delta L absolute value, is less than or equal to absolute value sum over j sub l and I sub j, l in the bad set, of 2 times m times delta l. So that's just a very gross estimate over of the two expressions involving phi. And this is less than or equal to 2m times delta, and delta is less than epsilon, so this is less than 2m times epsilon. Also, absolute value summation over j summation, j sub l and I sub j, l in the good set of phi of the quantity phi composed with f at t, j minus phi composed with f at s, l, all times delta l, is less than or equal to, by the definition of the good set, summation absolute value summation over j, summation j sub l and I sub j, l in the good set of epsilon times delta l. Because the good set is where phi composed with f at t, j minus phi composed with f at s, l is less than epsilon. Or actually, it's less than delta, which is less than epsilon. However, the last line does not exceed, when you add up all those intervals, b minus a times epsilon. So putting together our estimates, we find that the Riemann sum of phi composed with f at p minus the Riemann sum of phi composed with f at q is less than epsilon times 2m, that was our first estimate, plus b minus a, that's our second estimate. And m is fixed, m is an upper bound for absolute phi, b minus a is fixed, that's the length of the interval. So this tells us that the difference of these two Riemann sums is arbitrarily small. And we can get a similar estimate for the Riemann sum of phi composed with f at p prime minus the Riemann sum of phi composed with f at q. And so that, using one of our earlier lemmas, that shows that phi composed with f is integrable. An easier result is that f is Riemann integrable on an interval ab, and if mu from alpha beta to ab is continuously differentiable, then f composed with mu is Riemann integrable. And we'll treat this in the exercises. This is just a straightforward application of the mean value theorem. Corollary, if f and g are Riemann integrable on ab, then so is f times g. And we can give a real cute proof of this just using what we've developed so far in this lecture. By an earlier theorem, f plus g is integrable. By the lemma, f plus g quantity squared is integrable, so we're letting phi be the square function. So that's f squared plus 2fg plus g squared is integrable. But the lemma also tells us that f squared is integrable and g squared is integrable. And we can subtract each of those from f squared plus 2fg plus g squared and conclude that 2f times g is integrable. Then we could multiply by a half and conclude that f times g is integrable. So that takes care of that result. Now here's the change of variable formula. See if you recognize it. Let f be an integrable function on an interval ab of positive length. Let psi be a continuously differentiable function from another interval alpha beta of positive length into ab. Assume that psi is increasing 1 to 1 and onto. Then the integral from a to b of fx dx equals the integral from alpha to beta of f of psi of x times psi prime of x dx. Proof. Since f is integrable, its absolute value is bounded by some number m. We prove that in an exercise. Fix epsilon be bigger than zero. Since psi prime is continuous on the compact interval alpha beta, it is uniformly continuous, hence we may choose delta bigger than zero so small that if absolute s minus t is less than delta, then psi prime s minus psi prime t at absolute value is less than epsilon divided by the quantity m times beta minus alpha. If capital script P equals P naught through PK is any partition of AB, then there is an associated partition capital script P tilde, which is psi inverse of P naught, psi inverse of P1 through psi inverse of PK. And that's a partition of alpha beta. For simplicity, denote the points of capital script P tilde by lowercase pj tilde. Let us choose the partition script P so fine that the mesh of P tilde is less than delta. If tj are points of ij, which is pj, pj, pj minus 1, pj, then there are corresponding points sj, which are defined to be psi inverse of tj, and those points, of course, lie in ij tilde, which is pj minus 1 tilde comma pj tilde. Then we have summation j equals 1 to k of ftj delta j is summation j equals 1 to k ftj times pj minus pj minus 1, which, using the definitions, is the summation from j equals 1 to k of f of psi of sj, because tj is psi of sj, times psi of pj tilde minus psi of pj tilde minus pj minus 1 tilde. And using the mean value theorem, this is summation j equal 1 to k f of psi of sj times psi prime of uj times pj tilde minus pj minus 1 tilde. Problem that we have now, which is the kind of thing a good analyst knows how to deal with, is that F composed of psi is evaluated at Sj, whereas psi j psi prime is evaluated at Uj. And those are different points, at least they could be. So we must do some estimation to correct that problem. The last displayed line equals summation j equal 1 to k, F composed of psi of Sj, psi prime Sj times Pj tilde minus Pj minus 1 tilde, plus summation j equals 1 to k, F psi of Sj times psi of Uj minus psi of psi prime of Uj minus psi prime of Sj, quantity times quantity Pj tilde minus Pj minus 1 tilde. So you see there that we're addressing directly the difference between psi prime at Uj and psi prime at Sj. The first sum is a Riemann sum for F of psi of x times psi prime of x. That's good. That's what we want. The second sum is an error term. Since the points Uj and Sj are elements of the same interval ij tilde of less length less than delta, we could conclude that psi prime at Uj minus psi prime of Sj is less than epsilon divided by the quantity m times beta minus alpha. That's the error term, which is the second sum in the last displayed equation. Does not exceed summation j equal 1 to k, capital M times epsilon over m, the quantity m times absolute beta minus alpha times pj tilde minus pj minus 1 twiddle, and that equals epsilon over beta minus alpha times summation j equal 1 to k, pj tilde minus pj minus 1 twiddle, and that equals epsilon, because the summations of the pj tilde minus pj minus 1 twiddle, of course, just adds up to the length of the interval, which is beta minus alpha. And that cancels the beta minus alpha in the denominator. This shows that every Riemann sum for f on AB with sufficiently small mesh corresponds to a Riemann sum for f of psi of x times psi prime of x on alpha beta plus an error term of size less than epsilon. A similar argument shows that every Riemann sum for f of psi of x times psi prime of x on alpha beta with sufficiently small mesh corresponds to a Riemann sum for f on AB plus an error term of magnitude less than epsilon. We conclude then that the integral of f on AB, which exists by hypothesis, and the integral of f composed of psi of x times psi prime on alpha beta, which exists by the corollary to the lemma, agree. Let us now analyze the integral from 0 to 1 of sine of the quantity x cubed plus x times the quantity 3x squared plus 1 dx. We let f of t be sine t, and psi of x be x cubed plus x. Then we see that the integral has the form integral 0 to 1, f composed of psi at x times psi prime of x dx. Here psi maps 0, 1 to 0, 2, as you can plainly see. By the theorem, this integral is equal to the integral from 0 to 2 of f of t dt, which is the integral from 0 to 2 of sine t, and that's a trivial integral to evaluate. We'll conclude this lecture with a very important fundamental theorem of calculus, which is commonly attributed to Isaac Newton, but in fact it was known in some form to his teacher Isaac Barrow, and of course Leibniz discovered it independently. Let f be an integrable function on the interval AB. For x and AB, we define capital F at x to be the integral from a to x of f of s ds. If f is continuous at x and AB, then capital F prime x equals little fx. So fix x and a, b, let epsilon be greater than 0, choose by the continuity of f and x a delta bigger than 0 such that if s minus x in absolute value is less than delta, then absolute value of fs minus fx is less than epsilon. So that's just uniform continuity. Well, it's just continuity at x. We may assume that delta is less than the minimum of x minus a and b minus x. If absolute t minus x is less than delta, then absolute value of the fraction capital Ft minus capital Fx divided by t minus x, take away little f and x, absolute value equals, and we just write out what everything is, absolute value. Upstairs we have the integral from a to t of fs ds, that's the definition of capital F at t, minus the integral from a to x of f of s ds, that's the definition of capital F at x, all divided by t minus x, take away f at x. Now those two integrals and the big fraction, of course, could be combined to give the integral from x to t of f of s ds divided by t minus x. And we can write fx, think of fx as a constant, times the integral from x to t of fx ds. See, s is a dummy variable here. You're just integrating a constant divided by t minus x. So you're multiplying f at x by t minus x by doing the integral, and then you're dividing that out again, and you just get f at x back. So we end up with the absolute value of the integral from x to t of the quantity fs minus fx ds divided by t minus x. We could take the absolute value signs and put them inside the integral. So this last line is majorized by the integral from x to t of absolute value of the quantity fs minus fx ds divided by t minus x. And of course, by continuity, and the fact that t minus x is smaller than delta, that guarantees that s minus x is smaller than delta, and therefore fs minus fx in absolute value is smaller than epsilon. So we have this majorized by the integral from x to t of epsilon ds divided by t minus x, and this is, of course, equal to epsilon. A similar estimate holds when t is less than x, and therefore we have proved that the limit as t goes to x of ft minus fx over t minus x exists and equals little f of x, and that means that capital F prime x exists and equals little f of x. That's the fundamental theorem of calculus. And, I mean, the argument I just gave hypothesized that x was strictly between a and b, but there's a result for one side of derivatives in a and b, which we work out in the exercises. Corollary, if f is a continuous function on a, b, little f, and if capital G is any continuously differentiable function on a, b, whose derivative equals little f, then the integral from a to b of little f x dx equals capital G b minus capital G a. So this is something which you use in practice all the time. Define capital F as in the theorem, then capital F and capital G have the same derivative on a, b, they differ by a constant. Then the integral from a to b of little f x dx equals capital F b minus capital F a equals capital G b minus capital G a as desired. Example, let little f x be the integral from 0 to x squared cosine e to the t dt. What is the derivative of f? It's not possible to actually work out what that integral is, but we can still answer the question. Let g of s be the integral from 0 to s of cosine e to the t dt, and let h of x equal x squared. Then little f is actually the composition g composed with h. Therefore, f prime, of course, by the chain rule, is equal to g prime of hx times h prime. The fundamental theorem of calculus tells us that g prime at s is nothing other than cosine e to the s. Obviously, h prime is 2x, and in conclusion, f prime x equals cosine e to the x squared times 2x. And that is the end of today's lecture. Thank you.